Alma Swan, Robert H. Newsom III, and Newsom Jr., and Robert H. Allen, and A.J. Tickle, and the public center for the athlete.
Good morning. May it please the court, Robert Anderson.
All right, you may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court, Robert Anderson. For the appellant in this case, the Commonwealth. This is...
It's hard for you to say that, isn't it?
Well, I want to make sure I wasn't the director. I momentarily forgot. But no, I'm not used to sitting on the right, that's for sure. In this case, after the Commonwealth had presented through the lead investigator on direct a brief testimony that he had received through Crime Solvers, an anonymous tip referencing the defendant, that was done pursuant to a stipulation where the defense attorney himself, in describing the stipulation, said that the Commonwealth would be able to bring out the fact that there had been this anonymous tip that quote-unquote pointed to the defendant, which led to subsequent investigation. When the Commonwealth, having introduced that stipulation over an objection, strikes me as a very odd stipulation. I would have thought it presupposed that there was no objection to be raised as to it. The defendant
But even the objection was not to relevance, right? So there was no question as to the information coming in for relevance purposes.
I think that's correct. And then on cross-examination, the defendant brought up a Fred Harold's, and he questioned the Commonwealth about the police officer, the main police officer. He wasn't sure about his spelling. He may have been at a hospital, but he didn't have records. And then at the very end of the cross-examination of this lead investigator, Detective Fortunato, in fact, the defense attorney questioned him about a conversation he may have had with someone in the public defender's office, I assume an investigator. Do you remember speaking with Alex DeRosa in my office about the other suspects that you looked at in this case? Yes. This is the 362, 363 of the appendix. Do you remember saying to him that you didn't know who Fred Harris was and couldn't figure out the spelling? That I don't recall. This was a case in Arlington involving crimes committed by a black male, but there was also questioning on cross regarding the fact that in Fairfax, similar offenses had been committed by a black male who was still at loose, at large, as of the time that the Arlington offenses were committed. Now, plainly, that went, and I don't think the Court of Appeals said or thought otherwise, it plainly went to the reliability, adequacy, and adequacy of the investigation. In fact, at page 15 of the appellee's brief, she says, I think quite accurately, referring to the cross-examination, this is a proper inquiry for the defense on cross-examination because showing other potentially viable suspects supports the theory of misidentification.
Mr. Anson, may I interrupt again? Going back to the original direct examination, the trial court's ruling was that, and the prosecutor's proffer was that, it was not being offered for the truth of the matter asserted, right? It's only being offered to show how the investigation narrative played out, which is regularly done in these cases. So there's no Crawford issue at all, right? Testimonial or not, it's not hearsay, therefore Crawford is inapplicable because only testimonial hearsay is covered by Crawford.
Well, clearly, I think that on direct, there's no either hearsay or confrontation clause issue, and it's noteworthy that the defendant in his brief is not asserted in this court that as of the conclusion of the direct appeal there was any confrontation clause violation.
You mean the direct exam?
Oh, excuse me, direct exam. And, in fact, it's rudimentary under the recent U.S. and Virginia Supreme Court decisions, starting with the U.S. Supreme Court case in Crawford, that evidence that is presented, it's basically a hearsay notion, evidence that is presented for something other than the truth of the matter asserted is, one, it's not hearsay, and two, it doesn't implicate the Confrontation Clause.
Counsel, let's go to page 504 of the Joint Appendix. Lines 13 through 19. This is the closing argument of the Commonwealth. Quote, "Finally, and most importantly, we have two other pieces of evidence. First, Detective Fortunato told you that the tip he received said that the defendant said he had to lay low because of something he did at an unknown hotel. That's a statement of the defendant. You can consider that, and you should consider that." End quote. Counsel, it certainly sounds like the Commonwealth is saying you can consider that for its truth, and you should consider that for its truth. Tell me how I have misinterpreted it.
I think Your Honor's description is correct. It's hard to read that as anything other than going to the truth of the matter asserted, but I'd say several things beyond that. I would certainly say that in terms of the overall record in this case, that's the most problematical thing for the appellant in this matter. But for several reasons, I don't think that that's a proper basis for affirming in the present appeal. First, there was no objection to that argument, which, by the way, was the only even.
But there had been an objection to the evidence coming in the first place, correct?
Well, there had been on redirect on the limited portion that came in. But again, there were two separate assignments. There were multiple assignments of error in the Court of Appeals. One was the one we're concerned with today, which is the only one the Court of Appeals said it was addressing and was reversing on. A second, clearly related but distinct, was the denial of instruction J, which I think is at page 67 of the appendix. And at the beginning of that day's proceedings, there were arguments, which is, I think, at pages, I think it's 470 through 476 of the appendix, relating to that instruction. Now, I think clearly that statement has reference to instruction J and the denial of it, but that was not assigned as cross error. And if there's one thing that's quite clear in this case, something that was not assigned as cross error is not properly before the court now. Now, there's a question, by the way, as to whether failure to assign cross error is, in effect, a default of that instruction J issue. The Horner case, which I've cited, a jurisdictional issue, after the Attorney General raised a jurisdictional issue in the Court of Appeals, which didn't address it, or either didn't address it or rejected it. And this court said quite clearly that the jurisdictional issue was not before it because of the failure to sign as cross error. It remanded it to the trial court and didn't say, it said it's limited to these issues, none of which included the jurisdictional issue, which suggests that it went by the boards. I will concede, however, that in the more recent case of Tuma, which has a somewhat equivalent procedural posture as in the present case, it was sent back for a remand. So, Your Honors.
Well, I'll leave it to Justice Mims to decide whether or not you answered his question, but I didn't see it.
I don't think.
You've only got 6 minutes left. Go ahead.
I'll put it in simple terms. I think that the only assignment of error or two errors before this court concern a mid-trial ruling. I think that the correctness or lack of correctness of that ruling is judged on the basis of the record at that time. I don't think that.
Let me ask you this. Did the defendant object to the prosecutor's argument?
The argument that Justice
at trial.
Has referred to?
Right.
No.
So if the defendant wanted to appeal that, he should have raised it on appeal, and he should argue that he had authority to raise it on appeal under 525, and he didn't do either one.
It's about as complete a default as as one could imagine.
Wait a minute. Hold up. The defendant objected to it as it came in and was overruled. And as a result, the trial court's already ruled that it is admissible. Why is it necessary under statutory provisions for a new objection to be made at the argument stage?
Well, I think for one thing, it's not entirely clear. If you look at the court's remarks from start to finish, it's not entirely clear to me whether the court ever said quite forthrightly that the statement could come in for only limited purposes as to explicate or explain or expound upon the investigation versus more substantive.
Well, but the Commonwealth never proffered it as coming in for the truth. The Commonwealth proffered to the court, it's coming in for the reason that you originally said. Commonwealth never said, oh yeah, we want to use it for the truth and we're going to talk about it at the end of our closing argument.
Well, that was certainly true on direct, but when the argument came up in reference to the challenged redirect testimony, the Commonwealth certainly didn't at that point. The Commonwealth's whole argument was that the cross-examination, which plainly went far beyond the very limited direct examination, had gone into questions that implicated guilt or innocence. It had opened the door. And the Commonwealth certainly was not arguing on redirect that it was limited in that fashion.
Commonwealth, Mr. Anderson, ultimately what it comes down to is this. The Commonwealth proffered that this is coming in for something other than the truth, and then the Commonwealth used it for the truth. Is that correct?
No, I don't think it's certainly true on direct. I don't think it's true in terms of the redirect.
Where did the Commonwealth proffer, we're going to use this for the truth of the statement?
I think if nothing else, by implication, it did, because it pointed out that the defendant had opened the door. Let's see. Well, for example, at page 367 and 366, that's the portion mark, but I think that page 365, the prosecutor says, this is an evidentiary ruling, once otherwise inadmissible evidence is touched upon in fairness, once they've opened the door, it can come, this is it, I assume that means in, it's not a profit issue anymore, they've opened the door. So, I think the Commonwealth was at that point signaling its view that the evidence come in for
in
more
cross-examination.
Purposes.
Did the defendant's counsel, when the cross-examiner asked far more detail of the anonymous tips, did the cross-examiner limit the cross-examination and the answers given to the cross-examination to non-hearsay purposes, or did the cross-examiner go into the hearsay itself, thus opening the door?
The cross-examination was the slightest limitation, either in terms of the formulation of the questions, the answers given. The jury had not the slightest indication it was anything other than for
so
whatever probative value attached to it.
Cross-examination opens up a topic that had not been opened up before. It arguably was inadmissible for various grounds, and the direct examiner is allowed to go through the door that's already been opened by somebody else.
That's right, Your Honor, and that's something that's not a novel.
The question is, what is the door open to, and how far is it open? That's the issue in this case. If the statement from the tipster had been, you might want to check out Mr. Swan, well, maybe that would have been admissible and not really a Crawford issue for confrontation, particularly in light of the fact that the cross-examination of the defense, by the defense, had elicited names of people. But here's the problem. Swan told her he had to lay low because of something he did at an unknown hotel. That's the problem in this case.
Well, I never did reserve rebuttal, so let me just try to answer that quickly. Two points. One, I don't think this court has specifically addressed the exact question we have here. But some other courts have said quite plainly and have held quite plainly that evidence that otherwise could not have come in because of the Confrontation Clause could come in based on the cross-examination or impeachment of the defendant. Second, this court, I think Justice Kelsey has alluded to it, in any number of cases has upheld the Commonwealth's cross-examination or presentation of evidence that by the court's own description normally would have been inadmissible. But because of what the defendant did in terms of presenting something to create a particular issue in the case, the Commonwealth was held to have properly pursued it and put on evidence otherwise inadmissible by the court's own description.
Now, what you're doing is just restating my point. The question is not was the door open. The question is how far open is it?
And I think it's open enough to reverse in this case. Only a small snippet of the total tip came in, which I think goes to the proper exercise of discretion by the trial judge in this instance.
All right. Thank you very much.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Amy Stitzel. I work for the Office of the Public Defender in Arlington and Falls Church, and I represent Mr. Swan. I'd like to go directly to the issue that Justice Kelsey brought up about if the defendant brought in arguably inadmissible evidence, would then the Commonwealth be able to bring in inadmissible evidence? The evidence solicited by myself, the defendant, on cross-examination was not inadmissible.
Why?
The evidence that was elicited was drawing attention, after a number of other cross-examinations, drawing attention to a particular tip. It was not clear if it was anonymous or not, not clear if it was from crime solvers. The only way to direct the detective's attention to that tip was with the only information I knew of how that tip was labeled as the Fred Harrell's
tip. So were you offering the evidence for the truth of the matter asserted, or were you offering the evidence only to fill out the narrative of the police investigation?
Only to start the narrative of directing the detective to the particular tip that was received, and then asking not what the content of that tip was, but the next question was asking about if you were able to figure out who Fred Harrell's was.
Well, the content of the tip identified Fred Harrell.
It did.
Well, that's an out-of-court statement, and if it's offered to prove the truth of the matter asserted, it would be hearsay.
Some of the content identified as Fred Harrell, but the reason I was asking about if he received a tip about Fred Harrell is because that is the only information we have to label the tip. It's not like there was information. There are 50 tips. They're labeled tip number one, tip number two,
so
tip number three. So
you can ask whether a tipster identifies someone other than the defendant in the tip, and that's not hearsay, but the prosecutor can't ask if another tip identified the defendant, because that is hearsay. How is that consistent?
Well, the prosecutor did ask originally on direct if you received a tip, and did that tip indicate Swan? The prosecutor did ask that. Then the next statement was not the content of the tip. It was basically a what did you do next statement.
So
then on redirect, I'm asking just about if he received another tip and what he did about it, as opposed to the prosecutor on redirect. The prosecutor asked that detective, what was in the Fred Harrell's tip? It's the prosecutor that asked the content of the tip. I did not ask the content of the tip.
But
the
can I follow you bring you back to the direct examination? What was the statement that was objected to in the direct examination by the detective?
The statement?
Mm-hmm. What was the testimony the detective gave that was objected to?
It was a question. So I objected to the question by the Commonwealth. The question was, and did you receive a tip that indicated or pointed to Stormy Small? And I made an objection at that point. There was a miscommunication about the stipulation. I thought the court had said that none of the content would come in, including the name.
Okay, what did the detective ultimately testify to?
He testified basically to what he did next. He'd never answered that question.
Okay, so there is no testimony in direct examination identifying the defendant in the tip. So you object to the question, and the answer was never given that would be objectionable.
So the next question is, the next statement is, I investigated Stormy Swan.
Well, of course.
So I think it's a reasonable inference for everyone to make, and the trial court agreed that that tip had been about Stormy Swan.
Well, there may have been a perfectly good relevance objection, but no one made a relevance objection.
Well, upon stipulation, right, I don't, I'm not arguing that it wasn't relevant.
Well,
I think that's why they
investigated
storms.
Let me finish this, and then I'll let you go on. In your cross-examination, you were given answers to various cross-examination questions. Did you introduce those answers or seek to introduce those answers for the truth of the matter asserted in the answers? Or did you only seek to introduce those answers to fill out the chronological narrative of the investigation?
None of the answers were for the truth of the matter. None of the questions were about the truth of the matter. All the questions were about what the detective did to investigate Fred Harrell's at that point, and also to investigate a similar suspect that matched the description for a similar crime in Fairfax who was out of custody at the time of this crime.
But, of course, the judge never was told that, and the jury was never told that. They heard testimony, and there was no curative instruction or clarifying instruction saying it was only for the narrative purpose.
The judge and the jury did not hear any information about what the tip of Fred Harrell's tip was, not any content. When the prosecutor actually asked what was the content of that tip, the detective said he couldn't remember the content of the tip. He couldn't remember if it was a crime solver's tip or a tip he got over the phone. No content was ever introduced.
So a tip that says I got something on Fred Harrell, that's not hearsay?
He didn't say I got something on Fred Harrell. I said, did you receive a number of other tips in this case? And there were a number of other suspects in this case, not just three. And I didn't ask. He said yes to that. And then the next question was, you received a tip about Fred Harrell's, something to that effect.
Okay, that's not hearsay if it's not otherwise limited?
I didn't ask what was in that tip. It was limited to, what did you do to investigate Fred Harrell's, was the next question. So there was no content. All the other answers the detective answered at that point about the other suspects and the other tips were not about the content of any anonymous tip or any tip at all. It was only what you did. He claims that he found out that Fred Harrell's was at a hospital, and he claims that he doesn't remember telling Alistair Roscoe in my office that he never figured
out. I finally figured out how we're missing each other. There are two levels of hearsay. There's the statement made to the tipster, and there's a tipster statement made to crime solvers. I was given information from Fred Harrell, and then there's the information that Fred Harrell gave me.
The Fred Harrell's, according to the record, is the police officer says it was either to his phone or on the phone. He doesn't remember if it was a call about Fred Harrell's. As opposed to the Swan tip, that is from a female to crime solvers to the detective. And the female claims that it came from Swan. So that's hearsay upon hearsay upon hearsay. Three levels of hearsay. As opposed to the Fred Harrell's, one, I didn't ask anything about what was said. And then two, it's he's possibly saying he received a call and he was on the phone.
I understand your position. On direct, the question was limited to did you get a tip? Yes. As a result of the tip you got, what did you do? I investigated Mr. Swan. So everybody in the world knew that that tip had to do with Mr. Swan.
Yes.
So when it gets to a cross-examination, there are questions about possible other tips that may or may not lead to a source of investigation. But there wasn't anything about what the tipster said.
Correct.
It had to do with investigation.
Correct.
So then we get to the opening of the door question, and your position is that the door may have been opened to confirming that the tip that had come to the detective was about Mr. Swan, because that's what you just did. But you didn't ask for what the content was, and you're objecting to the content being revealed on this redirect. That's your position.
That's correct.
So the real issue in this case is the content of the tipster that Mr. Swan, I had it right here, Mr. Swan was upset about something he had done at an unnamed hotel. That's what you're objecting to.
Correct.
Not the identification of Swan as the person who was the subject of a tip.
Right. Well, not on appeal. Yes, I didn't raise that as an issue.
Right.
So it's the content of Swan tip coming in.
Right.
Also, I on cross-examination, I never asked at all about the content of the Swan tip. And then that is what allegedly under the guise of I need to fix her argument that the investigation was poor means I get to introduce the content of the Swan tip. So opening the door arguably to maybe the Fred Harold's tip turns into the whole entire content of the Swan tip gets to come in. And the reason it's coming in is to explain an investigation when the Commonwealth attorney is not asking. It would be different. Why did you only follow up on the Swan tip, but you didn't follow up on the Fred Harold's tip? Why did you follow up on the Swan tip, but you didn't follow up on the similar suspect who matched the description, who committed the same kind of crime in Fairfax and was out of custody? Why didn't you follow up on any of those things? Why did you only focus on Swan? The Commonwealth attorney did not do any of that. That would have been proper follow-up to rebut the claim of a defense to a poor investigation.
Did you ask that question? Why didn't you follow up on the tips?
I did not. I asked about...
Because if you had asked that question, that would have opened the door. Because the tip with Swan was, he had to lay low because of something he did at an unknown hotel. I'll follow that tip. I'll investigate that one. But you never asked the question.
Right. I did not ask anything about the Swan tip. Nothing. In addition, the Commonwealth claims and maintains that this was not for the truth of the matter, that the content of the tip was not for the truth of the matter. It's only to rebut or to defend against an allegation.
I think the Commonwealth conceded today that it was for the truth of the matter on closing argument.
That's a pretty common sense way to see it, I think, in the closing argument. In addition, about the cross-appeal issue, I'm not sure if anyone's interested in hearing about that, but we do not maintain that the Court of Appeals erred in any way. So that's why we did not assign a cross-appeal. We are not saying that the Court of Appeals erred by not deciding about the limiting instruction or the eyewitness identification expert or our other third issue. We agree with the Court of Appeals that because they decided the issue on the most narrow area on the content of the tip, that they then did not need to decide on the instruction issue. So I would ask the Court if the Court is inclined to grant the Commonwealth's what the Commonwealth is asking for, to remand this back to the Court of Appeals to decide on those other issues if they would have decided differently. And then we would come back again. Your Honors, Justices, this is a case where Mr. Swan was confronted by hearsay upon hearsay of a woman claiming that he told her something and did not have any ability to confront that witness. There's not been any case besides the Reed case is the closest case that the Commonwealth cites that says you can waive your confrontation right because of some sort of evidentiary issue or default by the defense. For the defense to waive a constitutional right, it needs to be knowingly waiving it.
You can waive a constitutional confrontation right by not objecting. You don't have to state on the record, I'm hereby waiving my objection. You just don't object. That's a waiver.
Right, that would be a way to waive it if you don't object, but we objected clearly in this case. But
right.
The cases that talk about what it takes to actually waive your confrontation case set out standards. And it's in situations where the defense counsel or the defendant is being misleading about information, such as in Reed, where they would say, you know, didn't receive information that a third party committed this murder. And then the detective is allowed to say, well, yes, I did receive that information, and then I followed up and found out that someone said that third party wasn't there. So there's particularly limiting and misconstruing evidence to the jury, and the jury would be getting confused, and it would be a wrongful doing, I would suggest.
So you're not arguing that the concept of opening the door, or for that matter, the concept of curative admissibility, is inapplicable to Confrontation Clause objections. It just isn't applicable here.
Well, I don't think there's been any case that says it is applicable. I don't think the Supreme Court has told us that it is. I don't think that you would have to decide that today. But the only case, all the cases that support any kind of waiver of confrontation, the explanation is basically I told defense counsel to stop doing that and that they were doing this and the person agreed, basically kind of agreed to do it, kind of similar to not objecting. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Call the next case.